Hey guys, Michael here. A quick note before the podcast begins. We recorded this episode back on March 11th when the world was a different place. We were planning on publishing it to time with the release of A Quiet Place 2 and then doing a patron exclusive episode on the sequel as well. Now that its release has obviously been pushed back, we decided to go ahead and just publish this episode now. And instead of A Quiet Place 2 being our patron exclusive, we recorded an episode on Scott Pilgrim versus the World. So if you want to hear our Scott Pilgrim episode, you can join our Beyond the Screenplay Patreon and listen to it today. The link is in the show notes. We'll be back next week with an episode on Jurassic Park, so keep a lookout for that. But in the meantime, here's our episode on A Quiet Place. Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay. Today we are talking about A Quiet Place, the 2018 film directed by John Krasinski, screenplay by Brian Woods, Scott Beck, and John Krasinski. I'm joined by the Lessons from Screenplay team, Trisha Arand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hi.
And Alex Calleros.
Hello.
So A Quiet Place is a really interesting movie, and the video for it was kind of a special video. So to give some kind of background for the video we made for Lessons from Screenplay, way back when, in a previous life, 10 plus years ago, I worked with a friend of mine to launch a video series called Soundworks Collection. And it was this thing where we would go and shoot interviews with sound designers and sound mixers working on all the biggest Hollywood films. They would talk about the sound design techniques that they used. And it was really fun. It was the first time I got to go on the lots and like see what it was like to mix a movie in an actual soundstage.
Like Skywalker sound.
Skywalker sound.
That was pretty exciting.
So cool. Yeah.
Trent Reznor's house.
Went to Trent. Yes.
Hans Zimmer studio.
Still sorry.
Brian will hate you forever.
But one of the first videos we did, and one of the first people that we met, were these two sound designers, Eric Idahl and Ethan Van Der Rijn. And so fast forward 10 years later, A Quiet Place is coming out. I have Lessons from the Screenplay. I'm talking to my friend, Michael Coleman, who's the one that started Soundworks Collection. And he says he's getting ready to do a thing on A Quiet Place. Would I be interested in chatting with them also? And I was like, yes, that's such a cool idea, because this is a movie where sound is examined in all the different ways. It's part of the storytelling, and it's always part of the storytelling and sound in films. But it's obviously so front and center here that I was like, I think this would be a cool opportunity to go and talk to the people designing the sound and learn about how they use sound to tell the story. And so that's what we did. We got to go to the Warner Brothers lot. It was me and Alex and our friend Terrence. And we shot interviews with Ethan and Eric, and they were super generous with their time. And it became this cool video. And it was a cool way into this weird movie that also has a weird script. Like the formatting of the script is super fascinating and bizarre and out there, and we can get into that. So that was kind of the background of creating this video. And I think A Quiet Place remains such a cool study of the impact sound can have. As I've said before, I'm always looking for examples of very clear touchstones. Like when you're trying to create something and you just want to purely look at how does sound affect storytelling, you can watch A Quiet Place and it's just front and center all the different ways that it affects the storytelling.
What I always like a movie that can call a mainstream audience's attention to parts of the craft, because sound is the invisible aspect of filmmaking. And usually people only notice sound when it's like, oh, like Transformers should get like the sound award because it was really loud. And there's a lot there's a lot of sound.
Yeah.
But I think A Quiet Place is really interesting because it is, as you said, Michael, sound is such an integral part of the storytelling itself. And it affects the characters and it affects everything. So it's cool for people to have that experience of like, oh, wow, I didn't realize how much I was missing sound until I was taken away for long stretches. And then when it comes back, it's really intense. You know, there's parts of this movie where there'll be stretches that are very silent. And then you'll hear some music playing in an earbud. And it's like almost overwhelming. It's like, whoa, music. Like it's really loud and intense. And it's just like a normal song. But because you've had this absence for so long, things take on a bigger, I don't know, weight.
Yeah. Or like Regan having the hearing aid in her ear, and you hear this sort of like low rumble, and you don't necessarily notice you're hearing anything until she takes it out, and
yes.
you hear literally nothing. Right. And then it's like just playing with those like very soft dynamics.
That scene's brilliant, where she takes off mm-hmm. when she's trying on the new hearing aid. It's one of the most remarkable scenes I've seen in a while, where you're with this deaf character mm-hmm. in the kind of like horror of the silence, you know, mm-hmm. just like absolute silence, and there's no escape from it.
And I love what the sound designers said in your interview with them, and then you, Michael, and then you ended up putting it in the video, which is just that sound, you know, comes in through the back door in a way where, like, we often unconsciously hear, and this is similar to what you were saying, Alex. We don't necessarily pay attention to what it is that we hear. We automatically sort of assume, but we have so much more range, right? With what like we can hear than versus what we can see. There's so much that we can hear that we cannot see. And mm-hmm. so like, you know, even just sitting, we're in this apartment, like we can hear, we have headphones on, but like other, if we weren't, we would hear the traffic outside, and we would hear like maybe a plane going over, and we would hear like, you know, maybe the air conditioning that's on, even just like all of these, the neighbors. All of these tiny sounds that are creating a soundscape that extends so far beyond the boundaries of what it is that we can see. And so good sound design is able to build the world out far beyond the boundaries of the set that someone is in. And so this movie does that spectacularly. And the other thing that I think that they do, that they mentioned, the sound designers mentioned in the interview with them, is that we actually tend to trust our ears more than our eyes because of that thing. There's like this reptilian brain thing. I think it was something you were talking about where like if you hear a sound down a dark alleyway, you like immediately like it triggers your fight or flight or whatever. You can't see what that thing is, but immediately it like sort of sneaks into your brain and like and triggers this like deep emotional psychological thing. And so like it's actually I wish I had the data on it, but if we hear something versus see something, we actually that are incongruous, right? And we see this sometimes in editing where like we'll get a pre-lap audio mm-hmm. from a scene that mm-hmm. hasn't happened yet. We're paying more attention to that thing than what it is that we're seeing. And we actually tend to trust our ears more than we trust our eyes.
Yeah, I had a really weird experience with this where I was in an old apartment I lived in, which was a studio apartment, and the door was locked. And I was on the phone with my friend and I heard someone walk past the apartment, but the floorboards, I guess, were like connected to inside the apartment. Mm-hmm. So it sounded like somebody was walking right next to me.
Horrifying. Mm-hmm.
My mm-hmm. dog didn't react. The door was locked, but still my body went into like this right. weird mm-hmm. mode right. where I was like, logically, there's no way there's anybody in this apartment. But like my body just kind of went, but I hear somebody. So now I'm going to freak out a little bit. It was really strange.
Yeah. And it goes back to, we were also talking about sort of this thing with Blade Runner, right? Which is like, you know, you're building this like set and you want to create the feeling of like all of this life that's happening all around it. And so in Blade Runner, they do a lot of it with light. I think they do almost that thing, almost that exact same thing that creates this really built out and lived in world with sound in A Quiet Place. It's so cool.
You have to watch this movie in surround sound because like there, it's like one of the best surround sound mixes I've heard in terms of actually making you feel like you are in this space and not just like, oh, when a car goes by, you hear it behind you or something like that. Like it feels like you are surrounded by the movie, which is really cool. Am I the only one here who saw it in the theater?
I saw it in the theater.
You did? Okay.
Yeah.
Because like I had this feeling of like I couldn't even open like my, and I even brought snacks that I knew were going to be quiet, but still it was like everybody is so quiet. So then like during the waterfall scene, it's like everyone eats.
right. It's a cool movie theater experience because I think people aren't usually engaged that way where a movie is that silent, like with true silence for long periods where you actually can hear every little sound in the theater. It creates a different atmosphere.
Yeah.
One of the great things about doing all this work with Soundworks Collection was getting to, obviously hear the sound designers talk about the importance of sound, and it really helped me appreciate how important it is and how integral it is to the cinema experience. And I think that's a thing that we kind of generally know, but it was cool getting this deep appreciation. But, you know, we talk about a movie can have bad cinematography. It can be shot on an iPhone, but it doesn't feel cheap until the sound design is bad. If you put amazing sound design with a poorly shot movie, it feels like a movie. You still engage with it like a movie. And sound, it really is kind of the thing that brings it all together and brings a movie to life. And that's happening constantly. And that's what's so cool about A Quiet Place. You know, you were saying, Alex, like Transformers movies sometimes get attention just because they're so loud. And it's so interesting because Ethan and Eric have done all the Transformers movies also.
Right.
And they were really excited to get to do something like A Quiet Place, where I think a lot of people might think, oh, it's easy because there's not that much sound going on. But there's always sound going on. Mm-hmm. And when there's no other sounds happening, when there is no dialogue or explosions to put constantly, like you're just kind of laid bare. And so I think it's also a good movie to look at if you're making a film and just kind of getting into filmmaking, to look at what is the sound that's happening when there's quote unquote no sound. Because there's always sound.
And there's actually very few moments when it's true, pure silence.
Yeah.
And like that may, like, you know, talking to them in person, they were emphatic about like, we actually did that, because that's a thing that
you don't do.
Never. Yeah.
You always have room tone or something.
Well, I talked about it with Star Wars Episode II, right before the sonic charges go off. Like, my brain thought the speakers went out in the theater because, like, and I mentioned this on our Episode II podcast, but it was just like, you have zero sound before you have this big boom. And it was so affecting because, you, like you said, you literally never have no sound in a movie.
Well, it was funny because I remember when The Last Jedi came out, AMC theaters had to post some like notices being like, there is a scene in this movie where the sound cuts out intentionally. Please do not complain about the sound dropping out. Because people during the whole like Laura Dern,
the Holdo maneuver.
Yeah, the Holdo maneuver, the light speed.
Yeah.
Destroying everything. People were like walking out and being like, the sound went out. For a second.
It's like, people,
like, right. This is the best moment. You just thought it was a problem. Anyway.
Oh, speaking of people being annoying and sound, one of my other disturbing experiences in the theater of this movie was hearing the guy next to him trying to impress his girlfriend by, when there's no dialogue for the first, you know, however long of the movie, I just hear him, I didn't hear the entire thing, what it said, but I just heard him go, no script. All I could think was,
oh my God.
Right, because people think script equals dialogue.
Right.
Like, do you have any idea how hard it is to make a script for this movie?
Wow. Well, so no script.
Can we talk about the script for this movie for a few minutes?
Please.
Because in the screenwriting community, when this script like got out, basically, and of course, as you point out in the video, Michael, they didn't end up shooting. Like, there was a lot of rewriting that happened after the original Beck and Wood script like was written and everything like that, because they started working on it long, long before like John Krasinski came on board and they were able to get the movie made. But what they did with formatting of the script, you know, ultimately probably isn't going to change things, but it did really open up a lot of conversations about, why in the world do we write certain things the way that we write? Because they were dealing with this challenge of, we have to get this past readers. And the rules of like how screenplays are supposed to look on the page are so rigid. And so, like, you know, really when you have not a lot of dialogue, you know, a reader is, when you look at a page, and I judge a lot of screenplay competitions, I read a lot of scripts, and like when you look at a page and you see just blocks of text of action, you're like, oh, this person doesn't know what they're doing.
Right.
And it, because it's not broken up with dialogue or whatever, it's not broken up in the ways that like you're trained to, like, you know, when I was in college, they were like, no more than four lines of action. And so I still like find myself prejudiced against like larger blocks of text than that and stuff like that. And so really it was cool what Beck and Woods did when they just were like, we absolutely don't have dialogue. And so for pages and pages and pages of this. And so what in the world do we do to keep the readers, because they are your first gatekeepers, what do we do to keep them reading? And what they did was awesome. They messed with it. They messed with it all the way.
Like, hardcore.
Yeah.
Yeah. For context, if you haven't read the script, it's really the original script, because you can read the Krasinski script now, actually. It is online.
Oh, interesting.
But the Beck and Wood script is, it has things like pictures and stuff, which is cool,
like the Monopoly board they're playing,
right? Yes. And like, that's definitely helpful to give yourself a visual and stuff, but that's not necessarily playing with the medium of script, that's just adding pictures to it. But the way they really play with the medium is by playing with font size and bold and underlining anything that relates to noise or relates to sound. And we cover most of this in the video, which, you know, was one of the first videos that I wrote that we wrote together. So it was just like, it's still like emblazoned in my brain. but yeah. And then like at one point it's just like one page per like, and then he gets 10 feet from the shed and 5 feet from the shed and then snap, you know? And it's sort of like raised some questions in the screenwriting community, which was
definitely,
this is interesting and cool, but should people be doing this? And I think the answer is like, no, like maybe don't try to make your scripts cartoons. Like that's a little weird, but
right. You're not actually writing a graphic novel. So right. There's no reason to like chase it all the way down that road.
Right.
But just if you have an unconventional story, maybe you need to get creative about what's going on. And
yeah. Well, and that I think we're also at a point where their screenplays are used for different things at different stages.
Right.
And so like for pitching it and trying to sell it, like the selling version of the script, this seems to be a kind of more of a trend that's happening where you can get like experimental with it to try to convey even stronger what the final product will be like. Because that's something that if you read screenplays, a lot of times that isn't conveyed, the tone and the pace, especially pacing.
Yes, very
when
much.
There's like no dialogue. And I think that's why that series of pages, like you were talking about, Brian, of like each step that he takes to this thing, like there's one word per page. So you have to spend the time to turn the page. And that kind of gives you the feeling that hopefully will be happening on screen.
Yeah. And it reminds me of a couple of things. One was, if you've ever read the book, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, which messes kind of with the novel form in the sense that it puts like pictures and then that you sometimes you'll turn the page there, but it's actually very similar. And I'd be curious to have asked them this question at the time, but there's a character who doesn't speak. And so the character in that book that doesn't speak, he has a notepad and he writes down like single phrases and single words. And so there'll be a character, you know, just like a block of text where it's like, I was talking to him and then I asked this question. And then you turn the page and it says the two-word phrase that he wrote back on his notepad and like handwriting. And so the blank space on the page really gives those words more impact and weight. But I think also, and this is an ongoing question that the screenwriting community has had, not to get like too screenwritery for a second, but in action screenplays, as we all know, one line on a page equals 1 second of screen time, and then therefore one page equals 1 minute of screen time. We all know in action scripts that's not true. It's basically never been true.
Right.
And so with this movie that's essentially an action thriller, like I recently finished an action script. It is 80 pages. It will not be an 80-minute movie. I can guarantee that right now. But that's the whole thing. So mm-hmm. if you have a little bit of space to play with, obviously you don't want your screenplay to be 140 pages necessarily. But if you have a little bit of space to play with on the page and like page count to play with and you have an action sort of story, I don't know. I think this is an interesting approach.
Well, I think part of the issue is Bong Joon-ho and Kurosawa, like they would actually storyboard their movies ahead of time. So they are basically being their own cinematographers before the movie has even started shooting. They're mm-hmm. saying, here's what these shots are going to look like. And you can use a drawing to say, here's what I'm actually envisioning for this shot. And it absolutely comes through in both their movies. Everything looks so purposeful. But obviously most people aren't doing that. Most people are just, we have the medium of text to communicate an entire movie. And what you can communicate pretty well is dialogue.
Yeah.
And what you can communicate pretty well is setting. What you can't communicate as well is action. And what you can't communicate almost at all is sound and music.
Exactly.
You can say like the music swells, or you can say Elvis Costello's Allison starts playing, where it's like someone has to go find that song now and like put it on. Yeah. And I think that's just an unfortunate product of the medium of screenwriting, is that it's also cool that you're like, what can you do with just text? But it's unfortunate that basically you have to communicate so many things about what a movie is, and you don't have to, you can leave some of that to the director, obviously. I mean, you're going to leave some of that to the director, but you have to communicate so much about what you want your movie to be using just a white page with black text on it.
Right. And that's the challenge.
Yeah. And I think there is an evolution happening, and I think it's probably going to continue to happen. Like, I think at the end of the day, you're still going to need a traditional screenplay because it's also a production right. document. Like
it is.
There's right. There's a lot. Formats. There's a lot about the traditional format that seems so limiting, but also once you get to production, it's like, no, I need to know like this, the page breakdown and the scene numbers. And if it's too experimental, it's like, how do I plan this as a AD? You know, it's like you need some sort of formulaic structure there. But I will say that I do think there's something to what they did with the Quiet Place script as an editor and as a director. It's really gratifying to like get to read something where it's like the editing is coming through. You know, it's like it's like the direction is coming through, and it is hard for me to read scripts sometimes where it's like I'm trying to watch this movie in my head as I'm reading it, and I don't know if I'm clear on really the intention in those areas. You know, it's because the action is being written in one line, but is it really that brief, or is this a whole page equivalent of action in this one line? It makes it hard to like watch the movie in your head in those instances. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Yeah, well, and it's also interesting kind of the evolution that the script had as it went, you know, as it evolved from the pitch document to the final film, the John Krasinski version and the things he came in to do. And I was listening to an interview with Beck and Woods, and they said they'd kind of had this idea and they would kind of work on it for a while and then put it in a drawer and then like a little bit later come back to it. And it was kind of evolving. And you know, they had the conceit of what if it was a movie with no dialogue at all, and the horror aspect of it. But they said it wasn't until they landed on, but it's also about a family who's not communicating with each other, that
right.
they realized there was the thematic resonance. And that was like, okay, now it's a story. And so it was cool hearing about that. And then kind of how they, you know, it got into the hands of John Krasinski, who also showed it to his wife, Emily Blunt, and they were like over the moon about it. And they are amazing. And like, they're just so adorable in real life and in this movie.
The crunts. And you
can't,
the crunts.
Can't help but like love them. And so it was also interesting hearing the changes that John Krasinski wanted to make. And like one of the strongest openings I feel like of any movie recently is this opening where the child ends up with the toy that makes the noise and it reveals why there's
that opening sequence does so much.
It
really
does.
It introduces the world and introduces the rules of the world. It introduces the family really well, and it's also the character's ghost. It's setting up the trauma that defines the character relationships for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, it does so much with almost no dialogue. Obviously, ASL is dialogue, but like there's still not a lot of that either. You
right.
know? But you are getting, I know, Alex, you said like you get kind of annoyed whenever the camera pans over newspaper headlines and stuff in a movie.
Yeah.
But
the opening doesn't bother me so much as like when it cuts to his basement.
The whiteboard. Right.
The whiteboard.
Yeah.
But it's like, what are you going to do?
I know. I give it a lot of credit because it's like, yeah, if they're not going to talk about anything, then you do have to kind of cheat at some point and just be like, here's the headline. Here's the whiteboard about the problem they're trying to solve. And, you know, here's him crossing off the like radio frequencies he's tried already. It's been like 400 days, but he's still trying. I don't know.
Yeah, I think.
Don't think too hard about it.
Yeah, right.
No, I think that there is this sort of like we basically have what we call the up prologue now. You know, like where the first 10 minutes of your movie is like something heartbreaking happens, and that's where the characters are, and that's very effective. And I think in Up, you're basically setting up who this one character is. You're not setting up too much else about the world. You're setting up sort of that character's journey.
Yeah.
And then you have something like Searching where you're setting up the characters, but also the format of the movie. Because obviously the intro is told the way the rest of the movie is. But I think that, as you said, Alex, like this is doing even more. It's setting up the world. It's setting up the characters. It's setting up the rules of the world. And it's setting up, it's getting you used to the idea that you are going to be watching a quiet, not a silent movie, but a quiet movie.
Mm-hmm. Such that when that the siren goes off on that thing, there's just dread.
And you have the what Eric and Ethan talked about, the sonic POV, mm-hmm. which is that you are hearing what the father is hearing, and then you're hearing what Regan is hearing, which is nothing. She just sees something happening, and then you're cutting back and forth. You do that with the aliens. You do that with like other characters where you are hearing like the headphones. Like you have one headphone goes on and you hear kind of half the music, and then both headphones going on, and now you're hearing Eric Clapton like in full stereo.
Right,
you
know?
And that's a really impressive thing.
And I think that it, highlighting that aspect of it, that sound can put you in the perspective of a character is super important.
Because
I think that's, you know, Saving Private Ryan kind of introduced this, you know, the shell shock thing, where the storming the beach and then the explosion goes off and Tom Hanks is like, you can't hear anything, it's all muffled. And that puts you in that character's perspective.
Which every movie does now.
Right. Yeah. And so it is cool just how, and it's so like simple. And again, it's a thing that you could write into a screenplay now, I think, and people would know what that means.
Right.
And suddenly you're seeing this moment from this character's perspective. I think it's a very powerful tool.
And then you have something like the when the lantern gets knocked over, it sounds like an explosion. Mm-hmm. And at no point are the sound designers of the movie or the audience going, oh, that's what it sounds like when a lantern knocks over. Like, that's not the point.
The emotional resonance or the
impact of this moment is loud and meaningful, so we need to kind of ramp it up a little bit. And you don't want to do that too much, obviously, because then anytime someone steps on a stair, it's like creak, you know.
Right.
But like to do that on just pick a moment like that, and then to really hit that sound hard.
I feel like they use up their quota of that in that scene because the raccoons falling also sounds insane
because they like scream as they fall. Yeah.
It's like definitely like an alien scream as they But then they kind of like then it's like earned from that point on.
Right. Yeah. And just to return quickly to that opening sequence. That was one of the changes that was made in the developing process of giving it to John Krasinski and talking with him. Because originally, the fact that the family had this tragedy happen to them was kind of revealed slowly over the course of the screenplay. It was kind of like a reveal. But John Krasinski was like, no, we need to like put that in the beginning. We need to know what's at stake. We need to understand what the family is dealing with. And that is so critical. Because also then nothing happens for like
a
pretty long part of
it. And like it's really important. It's important for a movie like this to like do something like that early.
Yes.
So you're really nervous. Because if you're gonna kill like the youngest, cutest kid in the opening sequence, then that means you're willing to probably kill another cute kid.
Right.
So like, and that's really important for a movie like this. And that's what Children of Men does so well. It's like, we killed Julianne Moore.
There have to be stakes. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. In the original script, it was actually that the flashback is the father is driving with two daughters, one of whom is April, who is Regan, and the other whom is Iris, who is basically Bo, just like the kid who is gone. And then there's a car accident, which the father isn't even at fault for, but then Iris dies and April's ears are bleeding and she can't hear anything.
Whoa.
And that's how she becomes deaf. And then the tension is still here between Regan and Lee, do you blame her for it? Do you still love her? All that kind of stuff. The tension comes from, I think, the daughter blaming the father and the father feeling guilty for getting into this accident because he was kind of not paying attention, but it was still like someone ran a red light kind of thing.
Right.
And then that tension comes from that moment. So it is a cool moment, but I agree, like just putting it all up front, accomplishes so much.
It's so important because I feel like the main thing, so if you are going to make a low budget movie, essentially, which I feel like a lot of us have or want to do, you are put in a position of, you want to create something special, unique, interesting about it. You don't want it to feel gimmicky, right? And so you also, you want to have that thing that you can go into a pitch, you know, and say like, okay, so it's this thing or whatever, you know, it's Bird Box, which like wanted so hard to be A Quiet Place. you go in and you say you have like, here's the weird, you know, high concept thing about this. But at the same time, and that might get your movie sold and that's good. Right. So like we talked to Anish and Sev about Searching and that kind of thing. Like, but and they did a great job in that movie of then actually telling a story and not making the audience feel like they're part of a weird experiment, because that's the thing that audiences don't like to feel.
Right.
And so a movie like Searching or this or Burp, whatever it is, like, could easily feel as an audience member, you're like, okay, well, you're doing the gimmick now, and like the gimmick is the gimmick. And so if it doesn't feel like there's a real story being told, if it doesn't feel like there are stakes, then an audience is going to immediately check out. So front loading, right, this horrible tragedy that happens as a result of, like, so starting it after the apocalypse, it's also just elegant exposition, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I think we were talking about this in Arrival, in the Arrival podcast, where we were going, like, you know, normally the alien invasion happens at minute 30 or right. whatever. It's already happened. It's done. It's over. We're now focused on this really human story and how they're going to deal with it. There's this horrible tragedy, and then it goes from there, and it gives the characters room to breathe, and it also makes it not a gimmick. And the fact that they made one of the central characters deaf and gave her a special skill to survive in a soundless world also is an amazing way to sell this. Mm-hmm. It's like, why would this family survive, right? You basically right. have to give your characters some kind of design that earns them. Why did they survive?
They all know sign language.
They all know sign language, so they can talk to each other and nobody else can. Yeah. Like, it makes sense, and it's just really smart writing.
It but also creates a level of tension as well, though, because if you can't hear, you can't hear if you're making sounds.
Exactly.
You can't hear if you did something that messed up. So, like, it's also a danger, which is also, there's so much, the character design in this movie is great because everything was tuned to maximize danger and problems for this family. You know, it's like she's about to have a baby, like right. she's about to like burst a baby out of her, which will not
can we not describe it that way? It's the worst way I've ever heard birth described. Like, honestly,
it's a really traumatic scene. I think I'm just like getting the energy of that scene up.
No, you're right. Yeah. I mean, and that is another, it's another smart character design where, like, it's kind of a ticking clock, right? You're putting a ticking clock right. into the movie the minute that we cut from the cold open, essentially, into that. And it's a really effective ticking clock because it's an unpredictable element, but one that you can't get rid of or leave behind, right? Right. And so it's just a really smart narrative device.
And I feel like, it is so intelligently constructed that, you know, in general, I don't like scary movies. And I feel like this movie is...
Me neither.
Hey. And I feel like this movie is chock full of, like, scary movie things. Sorry, Trisha, again.
That, I lived.
Good, yeah. That would normally turn me off, but I feel like because of the intelligent construction of it, it all feels earned, and that almost just makes it more frustrating to watch. Like, it was just so funny. I was watching it with my girlfriend, and she was having a very vocal monologue throughout the entire thing about how she was feeling, which echoed basically everything I was feeling at first viewing. And you see her... you know, when it reveals Emily Blunt, like, time has passed, and then you see that she's pregnant, you're like, oh, wow, okay. And then there's a moment where you're like...
You realize.
Wait a minute, movie.
Yeah.
Are you going to do this to me?
Yeah.
And then,
yeah.
like, when it starts doing it, you're just like...
When she goes into labor, like, right. that might be the most stressful feeling I've ever had in a right. movie theater. Like, that whole sequence is so... stressful.
With the nail, too.
The nail, yeah.
Like, Chekhov's nail.
Make it worse. Make it worse. Like, yeah.
It like stretches it to the point where it, like
it's almost unbearable.
It's almost unbearable.
Or it is unbearable, but in a beautiful way.
Right. And then it does crescendo and climax in this beautiful way with her scream and it
right.
It's almost the payoff is
bursting great. A baby out.
Bursting
She's screaming.
Wow.
I feel like it's almost not even a horror movie as much as
it definitely isn't.
It's like a suspense.
It's a what? Suspense.
That's how I would say it. Yeah, the British way.
It's a suspense movie that has... I feel like neither way sounds right now.
That sounded right.
But yeah, it's like a thriller that has these horror elements to it.
Right.
And I think that, like, yeah, it's a scary movie, but I don't think of it as a scary movie. I think of it as...
It's not horror. It's not right. It's not trying to get under your gory. Skin yeah. in like a grotesque way. It's about the suspense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I often think about the difference between horrors and thrillers. Like, basically, I don't know, and this is a very simplistic way of thinking about it, but basically how many people die, right? Mm-hmm. Like, ask yourself that question. And if the number is like more than four, it's a horror movie. And if
Infinity
it's,
War, interesting. And
how many named characters? Anyway, but just like
Infinity all War. Of them.
But just like when I went into this movie, you know, the cast is so contained. And of course, you know, the contained thriller is in itself a subgenre. And this, mm-hmm. even though it's like wide open space, is still a very contained thriller. Yeah. And actually, the film does a really good job of establishing, because this is one of the hardest things to do in a contained thriller. Again, I just wrote one. It was very difficult. But one of the hardest things to do is elegantly, like, establish some of the logistics of the containment. Right. Like,
why,
like,
do you have to stay contained?
Right. Exactly. What is keeping you in this place? And also, like, what's the layout of it? And especially on the farm, there are many buildings. And so it's like you have to do a really good job. And so that scene right at the opening where he goes up to the top of the grain silo and you can see the whole thing. You see the lights and the fields and everything that they have. You see exactly where the truck is positioned. It doesn't feel like it's exposition, but it is, because we need that information in order to understand how contained this is.
Right.
But again, because of a small number of characters, you're not really worried that, like, everybody's going to die, right? Because other than if they do, there's no movie. So you have, you know, six characters, essentially. We're going to lose a couple of them, probably. Otherwise, there are no stakes. But we're not going to lose all of them. And so that's kind of what makes it a thriller. It's about how are they going to survive this? And then the fun of watching it becomes about the ingenuity of the characters and about the ingenuity of the screenwriters. How are they going to push this high concept all the way out and all the way out and continue to provide surprises? That's what makes a contained thriller fun to watch.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think one thing they do so well in this movie, I shouted it out earlier, but it just make it worse.
Yeah, yeah. For sure.
It's a good lesson in make it worse. Just
the grain silo.
Like, yeah. Just everything.
Oh my God.
Like, they, every sequence of this film, they made sure to, like, mine it for, mm-hmm. like, how could this be even more horrible for this character, yes. in this moment? How could it be more dangerous, more impossible to escape? But somehow they do. And mm-hmm. usually when you're writing, your first thought is, well, I can write my way out of this. I know how to get them out of this situation. And it's a real challenge to, like, take it to the place where you're not sure.
You don't know
how you're going to get them, yes. out of it. Mm-hmm. You do have to go there in a movie like this. You have to write it to a place where you as the writer probably don't know at first how to get out of this. And because the audience can't know. You know, yeah. That's the whole point.
I love that feeling of watching a movie and going, I have no idea how anybody, right. could possibly get out of this right now.
I had that exact experience writing this contained script that I just finished. I had an outline for it. And, you know, I've talked to you guys a lot about how much I outline and I, like, don't like surprises. And I'm not very woo-woo about screenwriting at all. But I got my character into a situation and I was like, I know exactly how he's getting out of this. It's not that big of a deal. And so I just kind of trapped him more and more and more. And then I was like, literally, he's in a corner. I had a character that's trapped in a garage.
Oh, is it like paint is trying to get him? Right? Right?
What?
Guys?
Paint yourself into a corner.
Yeah.
Do you guys want me to go?
I want you to stay, Brian.
Thanks.
But I wrote this character into a like, basically difficult situation that there really, truly was no way out of. And then the thing that I was like, the only thing I can think for him to do is this very extreme, dark, confronting his, like, deepest fear action. Mm.
Perfect.
Yep. It turned out to be, but it was, like, quite a
journey to get there.
It was a journey to get there. And, yeah. and you know, even if, I don't know, I'd be interested to hear more, you know, from Beck and Woods, but, like, I wonder if there was some of that and John Krasinski, if they were just like, no, this isn't difficult enough yet, right?
Right.
Like, these characters are actually quite prepared. So you have to kind of take away and strip away all of the preparation they've done. And the nail is a great example of how. The nail is a great example of how to take away preparation.
Well, in the original script, like, one of the big set pieces is a silo, a vertical silo. So, like, I think it's the father who is going up, up, up as the thing is chasing him. And it's sort of like, yeah, what do you do when you are, like, and there's even a graph of, like, this silo is this many Empire State Buildings high or whatever, mm-hmm. like, this fraction of an Empire State Building. But the point being, as you said, like, there is no there, how do you escape from that? There is no escape from that, you know, and like putting the character in that impossible situation.
And it reminds me of a quote that Greta Gerwig gave in an interview about Little Women, where she was talking about her writing process. And she said that writing is just sitting with the problem. Mm. And I was like, yeah, that really resonates, where it's like that is what the hard part of writing is. You get to a point where you don't know what to do. And then your job, you are a writer, your job is to sit with that problem until you figure it out.
I'm so frustrated with that reality because yeah. I like to be productive. Like, I like to be productive and just have I did my work today. Like, I got something done. Like, I when I'm producing or directing or things that have tasks associated that you can check off and I finished this part of the process. And man, when I'm writing by myself and I'm like, I don't know how to solve this problem. I don't know. Maybe this is the wrong protagonist. I don't know. Maybe this, maybe that. And all you have to do is, all you can do is sit with it and think about it for a long time.
But I think there's something freeing about saying that's what writing is. Because instead of
saying, it's okay. It's okay.
Right. Instead of saying the problem means that you're not being productive, it's not that.
Right.
It's that part of being productive is sitting with a problem. You know, when I used to work with spreadsheets and stuff, I was like, I'd rather spend 4 hours teaching myself how to make a formula that can do this thing that would take me 10 minutes to do than have to do this thing for 10 minutes every time I have to do it. You
Dude,
know,
preach.
Yeah. But it's like, there's something so satisfying. It's like, yeah, maybe you didn't actually get from point A to point B in that day, but you spent the time to figure out that problem. It's a weird analogy, but I think it's the same thing, really.
Yeah, no, I think that's a super important, because writing is super hard. So you have to equip yourself with the proper attitudes to tackle all of these things. And I feel like that is an attitude that, for me, kind of led to creating lessons from the screenplay, even of just there's the easy way, but I want to force myself to do it the hard way, to learn the fundamental thing that's going to work more or less every time. Spend the time to do it the hard way so that you know you have the tools to face the problem, not just you figured out how to jump past the problem. Writing is hard.
I mean, that's absolutely true. It just also really reminded me of what we were talking about when we were talking about heists. So in the Mission Impossible video that we did, and then of course in the Ocean's 11 conversation that we had, we were talking about how everything needs to go wrong, and sort of the rule of, the less we know about the plan, the better it can go. Mm-hmm. But the more we know about the plan, it needs to go really, really badly, basically. Right. Otherwise, we don't want to see it. So, the situation where we see the kids are painting, they're soundproofing the walls, and we have this box to put the baby in. It's the baby box.
So dramatic.
Starring Bird Sandra box. Bullock.
Baby box.
But those things, and so those things, we see how the plan is supposed to work, but the minute that they get there, the basement gets flooded, the soundproof room gets flooded basically the second she gets in there, and then the creature is down in there, and so we have to take the baby out of the baby box, and so that plan is basically ruined almost as soon as it starts. So we know the plan, it goes terribly. Now, how she's going to get through labor, we do not know. They do not tell us. And so that's what makes that entire sequence so I think I still have nail marks in the palms of my hands.
It's excruciating. Yeah,
it is, because we don't know how they're going to do it. Now, it turns out they do have a plan, and the plan works perfectly.
Right.
But because we don't know the plan, the fun is watching it unfold.
Right, right.
So the golden rule of, the less we know about the plan, the better it can go, still applies.
Yeah.
Right.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I have a statement I would like to make. Emily Blunt.
Yes! Yes.
Yeah.
Thumbs up. No,
I was telling Michael earlier, when she's just sitting alone in her dead child's room and just crying. Like it's just it feels so authentic and beautiful and not overacting and not over anything. It just feels right and feels
like specific in the emotion.
Yeah,
like so somehow.
So she like goes through every emotion in this movie.
Because I was just thinking, like, yeah, like what do you tell me, Blunt, for this scene? Just like sit here and feel about
all
your dead
feelings.
About your dead son, like, and right. She just did it, and it looks perfect, and it's just perfect.
It's also amazing that they like either were about to, or had, I think recently become parents. Like
they
both
had
of them.
Recently both.
Yeah,
become parents.
So I think for them it was just like it was very. I mean, probably difficult, but also really useful to be able to use that sort of feeling to direct.
And
yourself.
John Krasinski has said that to him, this movie is about parenthood. He wanted to make a movie about parenthood, about the fear. Like the overwhelming love, but also
absolutely.
Just like the gut level fear that you have every time you have a kid and like every moment of having a kid.
To me, we're seeing like more and more horror movies be about a specific theme. It's not like, what if there were crazy things or whatever? It's like,
right.
It's like, no, like Get Out or A Quiet Place or even something like Parasite, which isn't quite a horror movie, but it's almost like treated like a horror movie. It's
right.
Almost like presented like a horror, where you have these things that it's like, no, this, the medium, we're using the medium, we're using the premise of the movie to talk about one specific idea in the way that A Quiet Place does.
Alex feels that way about Midsommar.
Yes. Maybe I'll write a video about it someday, Trisha. We'll all watch it. So I was going to say that picking up on that theme of parenthood and the deep fear of mm-hmm. parenthood, there's also the insane feeling of responsibility.
Yes.
And the regret. And that scene in the basement, whatever, soundproof place when she's talking about, I could have carried him. Like, that strikes such a honest chord with me, because it's like when a tragedy happens, when something like that maybe could have been prevented if something went a different way, the torture, especially a parent gives themselves over that kind of a like, it's just that's such a true moment for me in the movie of like, this is what this movie is about, basically, is as a parent, worst nightmare happens and you spend years going over in your head, how could I have not let this happen? And it's just, it's like so heartbreaking.
One thing that I think makes that scene work so well is the switch from subtext to text without a blink, like basically without a blink.
As like, Krasinski does like the slow turn.
Yeah. Because the subtext is, it's like there at every moment, right? Like every single conversation that these people have with each other, every second that they're together, the presence of Bo is there with them. It's a ghost for everybody, right?
Right, the whole family.
Exactly. And so for them to not address it textually and not talk about it in conversation or whatever, and then in that moment where they're talking about something else, like logistically, like the kids are fine, they're fine, they're like over there, they know what to do, they're da-da-da. And then she's like, I could have carried him. And like, she even says it that way.
It comes out of nowhere.
I don't think they ever say Bo's name, really.
Right.
Right. So it's just that it's the pronoun him, but we immediately know. And as an audience, it gives us that like, wait, you're going to talk about the thing now. And
right.
In the same way that I think it does often in real life, where feelings are hidden underneath the surface. And then the minute someone starts to talk about them for real, everything changes, and the way that we perceive what's happening in the conversation just changes our emotionality and our investment in it.
Well, it's so well placed in the movie too, because it's at this pivot point of, you know, things just got real. Things are real bad. What are you gonna do, John Krasinski? And she really challenges him. You know,
she basically assigns him to death.
Yeah,
she does.
She's like, protect our children at all costs. Like, go.
Promise me.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, bye, John.
Yeah, right.
But it's so, it cuts at that thing, that little bit of dialogue cuts at that thing of, it's not even about the lives of our children, although of course it is. It's about who are we?
It's an identity question.
It's an identity question. Yeah. Who are we if we can't protect them, right?
Like, what's even worth, like, why are we living this life if we can't keep
our
kids alive? Yeah.
And that's like one of those questions that doesn't have an answer, and it's just torture to watch people wrestle with. It's really, really well designed ghost and well placed, and it just loads everything. Everything in the movie is just, I was gonna say the word pregnant, but
pregnant with meaning.
It's pregnant.
I also want to shout out Noah Jupe and Millicent Simmons, real quick, because they're so awesome. Like, first of all, Noah Jupe is like in everything now because he was in Ford v. Ferrari and mm-hmm. Honey Boy. Different accents, different characters. Like, wow. he's knocking
so
out of the
good.
Park. Yeah. And then Millicent Simmons to actually cast a deaf girl in this part. And my girlfriend actually studies ASL. And we watched, as soon as the movie was over, she said, I need to look her up because I'm pretty sure she's like, she could just tell by the way she sort of, her eyes, like the way she sort of like scanned other characters and like looked at their entire face and everything. And obviously that's probably, that's what she does in real life, but also she's an incredible actress, and like have that on top of it is really, really cool to have not just one, but two phenomenal child actors in your movie. And the kid who plays Bo, he's only in it for 5 minutes. But
he's great
also,
too.
He's yeah. great. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was reading that they like people who, you know, are deaf and have been like watching it and reading the ASL instead of the subtitles or whatever, like have talked about how actually well studied John Krasinski and Emily Blunt and, mm-hmm. and the other Noah Jupe are, where they actually kind of have different like voices essentially in
accents.
ASL because not everybody signs the same way,
right.
But like learning to sign first of all, but then signing in character. So like John Krasinski is not signing as John Krasinski, he's signing as Lee. And like how sharp his movements are and like decisive and like forceful his movements are, like trying to be this patriarch and like be in control. And so like I was reading about how, yeah, deaf people who have seen this have been like, this is cool. And I'm sure Millicent Simmons was like coaching basically, right. That was like, yeah, that's too soft, like, you know, probably.
When they put a lot of effort into making them all feel like a family too, yeah. Like they would have family gatherings and invite the kids, actors' parents over so they could see what they're like with their parents and like kind of form this new family.
You know, you have a small
it helps
cast
when you're married too, like, well, to the, sure. yeah, the other
well,
actor,
it,
yeah.
But also young actors, like I've worked right. with a lot of child actors, and that's what you do. You just have play dates and hang out and like try to establish rapport.
I forget if I mentioned this on the podcast before, but I played Biff in Death of a Salesman once, and my friend played Happy, and he's one of my best friends in the world. And the couple who played, a married couple played Willie and Linda.
Whoa.
And it was just really cool because the four of us would get together with the director for readings and stuff. And it was like two pairs of us were already family basically. And then the four of us became a family, and it just sort of like added so much to it. And I think you can do that when you have a movie that is so contained and so small. I think like John Hughes used to do this with like all of his kids. He would just bring them over to his house, the Brat Pack. Yeah. And like they would just all hang out together. So that way, when you say action, basically, like you are seeing these characters who actually like love each other and have already formed that bond.
Well, yeah. There's a lot of trust, right? Like actors are able to be trusting in a scene, so like they can put themselves out there and give more generously in a scene if they like know the person they're acting with, especially if that's a familial relationship. So,
and I feel like it pays off like 1,000,000% in
absolutely
this. Like, there's very easily this movie could be subpar and really bad, and I feel like the way it was executed from top to bottom makes it something not just good, but special.
It's special.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. It seems like one of those movies that would just be like, oh, it's another one of these. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't.
Right. It's a $20 million movie that made $350 million.
Good deal.
So, yeah.
So let's make a sequel.
Yeah. I mean, clearly they have a lot more money for the sequel.
Yes, indeed. Before we wrap up, there are two little things that I feel like I need to point out. I just need to say out loud. The bathtub scene is great and stressful, partially, I think, because it references another cinema classic involving a bathtub, What Lies Beneath.
Whoa, not what I thought you were going
to
say. Trisha
was pointing at Michael, so excited to hear.
I was like, are you going to say Psycho? But okay.
Oh, no. Psycho is a shower. What Lies Beneath did for bathtubs what Psycho did for shower. That's what it said on the DVD cover.
What Lies Beneath. Was a huge What Lies Beneath fan back in the day. That was like a big deal.
Robert Zemeckis. Harrison Ford's only villain role ever. Spoiler alert. anyway, so I'm going to call that out. And then there's this weird thing that bothers me. I love John Krasinski, but the moment in the forest when they come upon the guy who's just lost his wife.
Are you going to talk about how he can't shush?
Well, the way he shushes.
Yeah, he like yes. he puts it. Trisha, this is a visual medium.
I want to know if I'm correctly imagining what you guys are talking about, which is the curvature of his finger.
Yeah, when he like rubs it past his nose, really.
Right. It's like he's so intense about how that the finger comes and then it hits his nose and it brings his nose around and then it goes past. So he's like, he's really intense about the shush.
But it never like crosses his lips or like lands in his lips.
I feel like he could have aimed a little better. I don't know.
Also, the old guy that screams is a little bit goofy. He reminds me of the bitter beer face in those old Foster's commercials. God.
Do you know who he actually is? He is the chief of police of Malibu from Big Lebowski.
Oh, nice.
Stay out of Malibu, Lebowski.
Anyway, those are really important
Leon
things I
Russo.
Needed to
yes.
bring up.
Yep. Thank you for bringing this up. Hi, everybody. We love making Beyond the Screenplay for you, and we love interacting with listeners. I'm constantly checking our iTunes reviews. One of my favorite recent reviews is from Poop One, who said...
Thanks, Poop One.
That's who took that username. Damn.
Poop One said, "This podcast is amazing. I have four friends who can't hear me say, yeah, you saw that as well. The perspective is different between the folks, but never negative on one perspective. I love the four of them being different and still respecting the thoughts of a different idea of a film, life, or where we all come from."
That's an awesome review, Poop One. You can think of us as Poops 2 through 5.
It's so weird that I feel strongly about being Poop 3.
But... please, please, if you are enjoying the podcast, we love hearing from you. And so please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or of course you can reach out to us on social media. We love interacting with listeners, and we love making Beyond the Screenplay for you.
Great. Why don't we go around and talk about what lessons we're going to take from A Quiet Place. Brian, would you like to start us off?
Sure. One of my big lessons, which is not my main lesson, is what I mentioned, which is like, if you're going to make a horror movie, like make it be about something. And mm-hmm. I love that. But because I did read the original script for our video, the one thing that really struck me, the original script is nothing like the movie in the sense of plot. Like everything is different. The characters' names are different. Their relationships are different. The way the daughter is deaf is different. Like the action sequences are different. But it does really capture the mood of the movie. Like reading that script, I really felt like I was reading the script for a different movie set in the same universe, because it felt like I felt like I was still living in this Quiet Place world, even though I was reading an entirely different story. And two movies that come to mind, two scripts that I've read in the past couple of years, are Good Will Hunting and Moonlight. And those are both scripts where I just felt like the soul of the movie was in this script. And sometimes it's hard to even tell why. Moonlight, like Barry Jenkins would just write something like, oh, they're standing next to this building. This building's been here for 100 years or something like that. Like that doesn't mean anything to a director trying to make the movie. He's making his own movie, but like, at one point, we see some kids on the beach and they're just playing and enjoying the water. This is the last, we'll never see them again. And like when you're watching the movie, you don't know you'll never see them again. But when you're reading the script, that sort of like punctuates this moment of like, pay attention to what I just showed you. We're going to move on. And I think it's really interesting because when you're writing a script, you don't want to write too much that is not actually filmable. You can't translate. But I really do think that there is something to capturing the mood and the soul of the story you are trying to tell. And I think I would not recommend going as far as Beckenwoods and like sort of making this like gonzo. I mean, nothing wrong with it. Like, why not? Yeah. But obviously there are going to be a lot of studios who look at that and by page two or like, get this thing out of here because this is not a script. But I do think that there is something to be said for peppering in those
unfilmables that are evocative.
Yes. Thank you.
It's also voice. You're showing
exactly
your
right.
voice, yes. which is tough because a lot of times we learn in film school all these rules about screenwriting.
Yep.
Like you were saying, like too many action lines in one paragraph, like you can't do that. And I think it's just there's a tricky balance of there's a reason for those rules. There are ways that scripts are like more readable when they follow these rules. But if you don't have any voice in there, then you also don't stand out. So there's that tricky balance of what's your authentic voice? Can it be somehow conveyed through the writing?
Right.
In a way that maybe doesn't always follow the rules perfectly.
And especially if you have a really unconventional idea for a right, movie, right. then maybe you do need to like try to push the rules a little bit and like yeah, get creative.
So they see the movie you're trying to make in, right. in their
yeah,
heads.
Exactly. Yeah. Because again, the reader is the first person you have to get. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Trisha?
So I'm going to go ahead and actually quote a screenwriting professor of mine who back in the day told me that characters should be better than real. And yeah,
What does that mean?
Yeah, let me get into it with you, Michael. well, basically all she was trying to tell me at the time is that like, so take a normal person who's full of contradictions, but basically boring. You have to turn the volume up on that person in some way. Right. And so actually one of the things that they tell you a lot in film school is put a character in your script that has some kind of disability. And it's interesting the way that like this character actually in this particular movie, having one of the central characters with some kind of disability, because the ultimately what you're looking for in your character is what makes them special or what makes them like extra equipped or what makes them like extra disadvantage, whatever that is, to deal with whatever is going on, right? And so thinking about the ways that you can like turn the volume up on a character, so like what is the thing about them that makes them particularly, you know, either disadvantaged in this situation where it'll be extra hard for them to overcome it, or like in some way especially equipped. So we see this a lot in like your classic archetypal things. It's like, well, Harry Potter is like, you know, he has the protective love of his mother. So like he's the boy who lived. And so he's extra equipped in some way. And that's, you know, like sort of a big example, but things like A Quiet Place are another like very small, very cool example of something special. What makes your character stand out from a crowd of other characters that otherwise would look just like them, right? And if that's their deaf, then awesome. I recently was rewatching Panic Room, and you have a T1 diabetic character in that movie, which I'm also a T1 diabetic, and I was like, this is cool. Like, it ends up being a plot device. Like, it is something that makes us special, like, in some cases disadvantaged, but, like, that's ripe for drama. And so, you know, thinking about stuff like that as you go ahead and like try to craft your characters, like what would make it extra hard for this character, or yeah, why do we focus on them? What's special about them? Thinking about that in character design. And sometimes like if there is nothing setting your character apart, just start going through that list of like, why them? Why this person?
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. I think they were back in the woods said that one of the things I loved about the script was that in the end, Regan's perceived, you know, disadvantage is her superpower.
Exactly. And, right.
And the exact opposite for the aliens, where their perceived superpower is actually their weakness.
Right. And that's often the thing is that characters who start off at a disadvantage, they end up being scrappier, more creative, like tougher than characters who like start off having everything. And that's cool.
Yeah. Absolutely. Alex?
I kind of mentioned my lesson earlier, which is just how well the character web is designed in this movie, of especially, I think, the father character and the deaf daughter. Just like both of them seem to be struggling the most with the guilt about yes. what happened and kind of with each other. Like almost they almost remind each other of that incident, and both are putting the blame on themselves and mm-hmm. carrying the weight of it and not talking about it, like we've been saying. And I think, once again, if this was just like a straight up horror movie, then I think those other layers could have been left out. It could have just been like a normal family trying to survive, but there's just so much more going on in this film with that unsaid guilt below everything. And yeah, when I went into this film, I was like, oh, it's going to be a movie about this thing, and it might be really suspenseful and good, but I don't expect more than the one thing. And it gave me way more than that, which was what was so lovely about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. It's kind of like what you were saying, Brian. Like, it's about something. It's about characters mm-hmm. that makes you invest so that you're scared when the scary things
right.
happen also.
Right. and really care about them as characters. Like, right. I'm so sure. with that daughter character in this movie.
Right.
Like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the main reason I want to see A Quiet Place too. It's like, wait, there's more. Okay. Well, I want to see what happens to her. I hope she's okay.
Yeah.
She's going to be awesome.
Yeah. I'm really excited. Yeah. My lesson, I think, just goes back to sound. Because I feel like that's the obvious thing here. And I think especially like we were talking about earlier, how sound can put you in a character's perspective. And I feel like so much of writing is trying to do that, is trying to make the audience see things through the protagonist's eyes or empathize with them, experience it along with them. And in A Quiet Place, it's so simple. There are just moments where suddenly you hear what the character hears and you are that character. And so I think that's just, it's a really valuable tool. And again, like I always say, I'm always kind of looking for that like film tool 101 example. And I feel like if you want to learn like what can sound do for a movie, watch Quiet Place. Like,
yeah,
there's all of it is here in this movie laid bare. So it's very accessible. And I think it's just, it's a really important thing to keep in your head when writing and especially when directing. Like, sound is such a powerful tool.
And we didn't even get to talk about dynamics.
Right, which is, well, people have to go watch the video because we talk about it in the video a little bit.
We do.
Yeah.
Well, and earlier you said something about how, you know, like a movie can look kind of, you know, it can be shot in an iPhone, but if the sound is good, it's like a movie. Mm-hmm. And I think it's vice versa too. You can have the kind of the film student mistake. The classic mistake is, oh, we have like a red camera. We're going to shoot a 4K like movie. It's going to like look so good.
And then just give Jeff a boom mic. He's fine.
And then like the sound is awful. Yeah. And like it doesn't matter how pretty your image is. If the sound sucks, like your movie is amateur. Like it's not going to feel right. And so it's interesting how sound is more critical in even just like making a movie seem like a movie than anything else.
Yeah. I feel like even like when making movies, when you're in the edit, I feel like I'm always terrified. And it's like, is this working at all? And then once the sound is in, suddenly it's like, okay, we made a movie.
Right.
There's
right.
something here.
Right.
I also just had a like weird, we're old moment. Cause you were like the red camera, it's in 4K. And I was like, God, iPhones are in 4K. Like,
right.
The time when the red was 4K and was cool, that was 10 years ago. Why don't we go around and say what we've been watching recently? Trisha, want to start us off?
Sure. So I went over to the Lamley in Glendale and I watched...
Lamley?
Yes. And I watched the Oscar-nominated film from Poland, which is called Corpus Christi.
Mm.
Did you see it?
No.
Oh, it's so good. Oh, it's so good. I think it's going to be showing for a while longer. So if you live in LA or like any major city where you have like an art house theater, they'll probably be showing it. It is excellent. It is about like a young man who gets out of juvie in Poland and he wants to be a priest, but he, of course, has like this record, so he can't. And so he ends up in this small town. He's supposed to go work like some menial job, but he gets mistaken for being like a priest essentially. And so he kind of just starts masquerading as one. But which I guess kind of sounds like it could be a comedy, but it's this actually like very, very moving story about this small town that's grieving. Like the town itself is grieving. There was this horrifying accident. And so like, as he's there, because he is just there to care for people. Like the reason he wants to be a priest is because he wants to care for people. And so as he's there and just that love that he has starts to like transform the town. It's really beautiful. It's definitely in the vein of First Reformed, which I talked about on our Top 10 podcast. And also this other movie that I'm obsessed with from 2013 called Metalhead, which is a movie from Iceland, but also about like rural small town, like grief. But it's really, really excellent. It's really well acted. It's directed by, I'm going to say it wrong, but Jan Kamasa. And it's an Oscar nominated foreign language film from this year. Very much recommend.
Cool. Awesome. Cool. Brian?
So I went to a double feature, 35mm screening of Stanley Kubrick's first two feature films, Killer's Kiss and The Killing. He also did a movie called Fear and Desire before that, but he disowned it. And I also saw it this year and I can see why. but they're both awesome movies. And I was really excited by just how much I love them. Killer's Kiss is sort of like a just kind of traditional crime noir, but you can just see Kubrick coming through. Like there are some shots and some camera movements where you're just like, wow, this is somebody who like really knows what they're doing. But The Killing is a masterpiece. Like, if you are a Kubrick fan, I recommend both these movies. But if you're a Kubrick fan and you haven't seen The Killing, like, I've now seen every Kubrick movie, and I'm like, shame on me for not having seen The Killing years ago.
All right, I gotta see it then.
Yeah,
all
right. It is so good. It's basically, along with Asphalt Jungle, which weirdly both star Sterling Hayden, who is Jack D. Ripper from Dr. Strangelove, mm-hmm. Along with those two movies are basically the sort of birth of the ensemble heist movie. Like, oh, we need a bagman and we need a driver and we need a this guy and whatever. So Asphalt Jungle is the first, but then The Killing, I think, is basically the second. And I think, having seen it, I'm like, every heist movie is just trying to be The Killing. You're like,
wow,
oh, that's The Town, and oh, that's Ocean's 11. Or like, you see all these things that basically then got picked up by other movies. And it's just, it's so well done. His camera work is incredible, but there's just so many scenes that are like thematically really satisfying and just like cool characters, and it gets like funny at some points too and just exciting. I was like so happy with just how entertained I was watching.
So, movie night at your house?
What's that?
You want to watch it again?
Sure,
like,
let's do it.
I feel like you've sold at least me and Alex on it. Am yeah. I fill you in?
I think I've seen The Killing.
Oh, really?
I think I've seen The Killing. Don't know.
It's a heist movie. It sounds like a Michael thing.
Maybe I didn't make it to the heist part.
What are you watching, Alex?
Wow. I am watching Devs on Hulu.
Ooh, nice.
FX on Hulu. It's the new Alex Garland production. I think it's a limited series that he wrote and directed. And it's very Alex Garland. It's both the upsides and downsides of Alex Garland. I'm a huge fan of his. So, of course, I was there, day one. And one of the most fun things about it so far is the fact they filmed, I think, like 80% of it on the UC Santa Cruz campus.
Wait, hey! What?
Yep.
Wait, what?
Yes, like the campus for like this tech company is UCSC.
Oh my god!
So like, there's like, you can see the library. You can see like they're like the Porter Meadow. I think is like the setting for like a big part. Like,
wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you see the tree Michael climbed?
That was just really fun, actually, because it was like I was dawning on me, like, no, this is definitely UC Santa Cruz. That's definitely the library. Yeah. So it's in a cool setting. And, Nick Offerman plays this very interesting role. And it's the super heady sci-fi that I love that Alex Garland is known for now. But there's also that, that Fincher quality to it. The almost too perfect, almost too staged, almost too roboticness to it as well. But maybe that's kind of part of the point of this one. I don't know.
You're just selling Michael so hard.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's kind of my complaint about it. But it may be for a reason, because this whole thing is about AI and do we even have free will and determinism. So it's interesting, and I'm not 100% sold on it yet. I'm sold enough to keep watching, but I'm curious to see where it goes, because it's a very, it's Alex Garland.
There are two episodes that you've seen as of recording?
I've seen two episodes so far, okay. And I'm very excited for the third. Yeah.
Cool.
Michael.
So I've watched a lot of things, but they've kind of all been for projects that we're working on recently, so I don't want to talk about them. I've also been rewatching 30 Rock, but I feel like that's cheating, so I'm not going to do that.
It is cheating.
So I'm going to do kind of a weird one, which is that, so I went to Yosemite a couple weekends ago, and it was gorgeous and beautiful being in the park, and I had the one thing that I walked away with, like, wow, this is so beautiful. It makes me want to play Minecraft. And so I've been playing Minecraft a little bit in my free time. The looks on everyone's faces.
Trisha, like, just,
I'm trying to get from Yosemite to Minecraft in the first place.
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking about how many, like, 6-year-old jokes I can be making.
Well, because Minecraft is... So also watching A Quiet Place made me feel like it captures a lot of what it feels like to play Minecraft as well. Because it's this, like, survival game where you're kind of... sent out and
Trisha's face is amazing.
She's on with me.
Yeah,
but
it's skeptical.
It's this game that's part survival, and as you play, you're kind of expressing your personality. Everyone kind of deals with it differently, and you can go exploring, and then you're going through a forest, and you turn a corner, and suddenly there's this huge, epic, beautiful mountain, just like Yosemite. Anyway, so there's all
just
these
like
things.
In real life,
there are corners in Yosemite.
Well, you emerge from the forest. And there's this beautiful vista, as in life, as in Minecraft. Anyway,
just trying to make this as difficult as possible.
Yep. I've been playing that some in my free time, and then also watching videos, because there's a million, obviously, videos about Minecraft and sort of these Let's Play videos that are also tutorials. But I've also been watching sports recently. Like, I was in the situation where I had to watch a basketball game, which was very fascinating.
You had to?
Well, yes. Basically, I was in a situation where people were watching it, so I was watching it. And I've been watching StarCraft, which is also an esport. Basically, I've been watching
everything but movies,
but it's made me kind of like, and movies, I just can't talk about which ones I've been watching, but it's kind of been an interesting mishmash of all these things that's made me kind of fascinated about how many things can be conveyed with an image and a sound. And I think especially watching A Quiet Place and seeing how much sound affects us psychologically, it's kind of made me appreciate the language of film, but also the language of media, and just that humans can watch different images flashed at them aligned with different sounds, and we can take so many different meanings from them, and the expectations we go into one medium really affects the things that we receive from it. And so it's a little out there, but it's
humans. What are you recommending?
Humans are crazy, is what he's saying.
It's not recommending. He's saying what he's been watching.
Yeah, exactly.
Sports is really interesting, though. Like, sports, because you have basically live producer, the dramatization of sports. You have a live producer who's basically has 8 camera angles or something, and he is trying to make live drama out of this. So, if one team scores a touchdown, you want to show all the people who are excited about it and all the people who are not excited about it. And like, there's actually so much going on behind the scenes, and it's really fascinating.
That's all I think about when I watch, is like being in that room and like calling shot.
I've been in that room. I was a live camera operator for several years. And then I also was a graphics operator in a live room like that for a couple of years.
And you were the quarterback for the Dolphins for a little while, right?
Also that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. You'll have to tell me about that sometime.
Well, it was a little bit less like storytelling than you think.
Well,
I can tell you that right now.
Stories emerge, perhaps.
Right.
From decisions that are made.
Okay.
We'll talk about it.
Okay.
Great. This has been our conversation about A Quiet Place. Let's all go watch A Quiet Place Part 2, huh?
I'm excited.
I am very excited.
Bye, everybody.
We're just going to be watching Trisha.
Yeah.
I'm excited to sit next to Trisha.